time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
To the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for August 24th, 2019. There are a lot of things going on in cycling this week, including some postings about and by Andrew Bernie Bernstein, a past editor of Bicycling Magazine who was hit and left for dead in Boulder, Colorado on July 20th. In addition to a lengthy August 22nd piece by Michael Roberts on the local Denver news source Westward, Andrew himself is posting on Twitter and Facebook, saying some interesting things about the man who saved him, as well as offering his thoughts on insurance, safety, and a need for better understanding between cyclists and drivers. This week's show actually runs along the lines of safety and the need for a whole new way to view the way we think about urban transportation here in the U.S. Jessica Cicchino is with the IIHS, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, and she joins me to talk about a recent study the organization did titled Some Protected Bike Lanes Leave Cyclists Vulnerable to Injury. It wasn't what I expected to see or read, and I wanted to hear what the study found. After a pause for a quick station ID, we'll come back to talk with Seattle Times transportation reporter Heidi Groover. Heidi reported on a controversy that left me a little baffled. If bicycle infrastructure had already been approved for a revamping of 35th Avenue Northeast in Seattle, why wasn't it implemented? I wasn't the only one who wanted to know that answer, as the two sides, those in favor and those opposed, were ushered into mediation by the mayor. We'll learn what the outcome was when we talk with Heidi. I do have a couple more quick news items before we jet off to Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, where I caught up with the whirlwind that is Michael Colville Anderson. He's sort of indescribable in just a couple of words, but his ideas about urbanism have produced books, TED Talks, videos, and a television series. His out-of-the-box thinking has also begun to transform cities and the way they look at how things move. So let's head to the offices of IIHS in Virginia to speak with Jessica Cicchino about their most recent bike lane study. Hi, Jessica. Thanks for joining me on the show today. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. How's Virginia today?
It's hot, but doing well.
hot and sticky, just like it is here in Ohio. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I read a piece about the study IIHS did about protected bike lanes. I wanted to get more information since you conducted the study. I watched your little video, which was quite nice. Let's talk about what a protected bike lane in the context of your study is.
Right. So we defined protected bike lanes as bike lanes that were separated from the road with some kind of physical barrier. So things that aren't permanent, so like things like parked cars would count as a physical barrier for us. And also things like posts, landscaping, things like that. If there wasn't a physical barrier and just a painted buffer, we did not count that as a protected bike lane. And there weren't a whole lot of lanes like that in the cities that we were looking at.
Okay, so where was this study conducted?
So we conducted the study in three cities, Washington, D.C., New York City, and Portland, Oregon. And we conducted it from 2015 to 2017. And what we did was we went to emergency rooms and hospitals in these cities, and we interviewed cyclists who came to the emergency room because they were injured while cycling. And they could have either gotten into a crash with a car, but also could have fallen and gotten injured in a way that didn't involve a car. And one thing that we did is we asked them to trace the route that they took leading to their injury. And so we compared the infrastructure characteristics at the location where they were injured to another randomly selected location on their route that day to try to get a sense of what kinds of characteristics might have the most injury risk.
So you picked, of course, three of the big cycling cities who almost always have some sort of controversy going on, too. New York, D.C., mm-hmm. and Portland. That was an interesting choice. And I think they're probably the best choice because of the number of people who do ride. When we talk about protected bike lanes, I didn't see it the way you did. Mm-hmm. I guess I look at them like, are they buffered by cycle paths? And I guess that's what's coming up. If you go overseas into Europe, you see things like cycle paths that are actually completely protected from traffic. But these are mm-hmm. not necessarily, I guess, right?
Right. And so we had some in the study that were much more protected from traffic. In particular, most of those were in New York. So there were some that were greenways that were within the sidewalk, some that were on bridges. And those were the ones that we found really did the best job of protecting cyclists from injury. And so when we looked at the injury risk on those kinds of protected lanes compared to major roads, we saw that they were much lower. They had about a tenth of the risk. But when we looked at some of the other protected bike lanes that maybe have less protection, in particular ones that were in the road, we saw that they varied a lot more in how well they protected cyclists from injury. And in particular, some of the lanes that we looked at actually had an increased risk compared to riding in the roads. And those were some of the ones that had the least amount of protection.
You also found some other things that were really interesting about who got injured and how and why. Tell me again what you do. We're speaking with Jessica Cicchino, and she's with the IIHS. We've spoken with Russ Rader at IIHS several times. Tell me what you do there and what led to this study. What was it that the IIHS wanted to find out about the vulnerability of cyclists? Because I know you do a lot of work in that area.
Right. And so at IIHS, we do research on a bunch of different things, basically things related to traffic safety, things related to reducing injuries and deaths and crashes on the roadway. And we've been increasingly interested in looking at pedestrians and cyclists because we've seen more crashes involving them. The fatality numbers in particular for pedestrians and cyclists have been going up a lot. And we've seen that cyclist deaths have gone up 25% since they reached their low point in 2010. And so we have been directing more of our efforts and looking for ways to best keep pedestrians and cyclists safe on the road.
That's a good thing. We really like that. We really like
that.
So you did discover something that I think would be counterintuitive, and that more injuries occur mid-block. Now, we understand what happens at intersections because of things like mm-hmm. right hook and things like people trying to overtake a cyclist in some cases. But you're finding more injuries mid-block. How does that happen?
So we saw that there were more injuries mid-block, but when we looked at the risk of injury, so when we looked at how likely a cyclist was to get injured based on where they were riding, we saw that risk was higher at intersections. And so we think there were more injuries mid-block just because people spend more of their time riding mid-block than they do at intersections. But for the amount of time they spent riding through intersections, we saw that their risk was higher there.
Okay. Well, that makes some sense. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So do you have any idea of how many miles of protected bike lanes there actually are in the U.S.? I know that's a huge question, but mm-hmm. I imagine you've done some studying of that.
Right. So People for Bikes keeps an inventory of the miles of protected bike lanes in the U.S., and there's more than 400 miles that they have reported now in the U.S., and it's a big increase. You know, just about 10 years ago, there were only about 40 miles of protected bike lanes. So we've really been seeing a big increase in cities in the U.S.
Yeah, so I'm hoping, and I am seeing a lot of cities are putting Vision Zero programs into place, the idea that there'll be no fatalities and no injuries in the future. 400 sounds small relative to the size of the country, but I guess compared to 10 years ago when there was only 40, it's a big increase.
Right, it still is small, even in most of the cities that have them. They don't, most of their bike infrastructure isn't protected. And so, it's a lot of progress, but still not as many miles of this kind of infrastructure as there could be, for sure.
So that leads me to another question, and I don't know how involved you are in this. It never occurred to me. We heard a whole lot at the last election cycle about infrastructure being an important part of any, I guess, administration's plans, and it seems like not much is going on in that area. Do you monitor that? Do you know what's going on in terms of Congress and transportation bills that may or may not include these protected bike lanes?
I don't monitor it closely enough to know what's going on right now in terms of if protected bike lanes are something that are being considered in some of the infrastructure bills that are out there now. I know that, you know, it's something that can get controversial since, you know, some people who aren't in urban areas and they're thinking of infrastructure, they're not thinking as much about pedestrians and bicyclists and the kind of infrastructure they need. So you always have this kind of, you know, urban rural push and pull about what kinds of infrastructure the country needs.
That's so true. Are cities cooperating in making cycling safer?
Many cities seem to be doing a lot for cyclists and really trying to put in infrastructure that encourages cycling and encourages safe cycling. I think from this study, what we want the community and cities to think about is where they're putting in some of the protected infrastructure and how they're putting it in and how it could be best designed to best protect cyclists. I think especially when some of this infrastructure is pretty new in the U.S. and we're trying to retrofit it on roads that weren't designed for cyclists, I think that's when you run into some of these issues about how to balance, you know, putting in infrastructure for cyclists and putting it in the best way that will protect them the most.
So the IIHS is conducting lots of research for the insurance industry, as I remember. How does the insurance industry respond to things like protected bike lanes or traffic calming measures? What is it that the IIHS can tell people, and do you get a response from them?
Right. So IIHS is sponsored by the insurance industry, the car insurance industry. So they fund all of our research. And, you know, they're interested in reducing injuries and reducing fatalities. And so even for all road users, for things that don't necessarily involve just crashes with cars. And so we always want to show them things that can be done and things that they can potentially support that can bring down injuries for all road users, especially since pedestrians and cyclists are becoming a bigger part of the problem.
As I remember, IIHS usually publishes these studies and some of the research that goes behind it on your site. Is that true?
Yes, we do.
Okay, so would you tell our listeners how they can find out more about this study and the other things that your organization is involved in?
Yeah, so they can find out more about this study on our website, www.iihs.org. This study will probably have a link to it on the front page, but we also have pages about pedestrians and cyclists that have some of the other research that we've done in those areas as well.
I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. We've been talking with Jessica Cicchino. She is with the IIHS, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety in Virginia. Thanks so much, and keep up all these great research studies. We need them.
Thank you very much.
All right. You have a great day.
You too. Thanks.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Jessica Cicchino joined me from the offices of IIHS in Virginia. If you are interested in the bike lane study and any of the other work they're doing in the areas of cycling and pedestrian safety, you can log on to iihs.org. We'll take a real short ID break. Then we'll come back to speak with Seattle Times transportation reporter Heidi Groover. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We're back. I'm Diane Jenks. On August 8th, Seattle Times staff reporter Heidi Groover's article, quote, "Still fuming about 35th Avenue Northeast, Seattle City Council considers new bike lane requirements," end quote, details the controversy that we often see between vulnerable road users and the public that lives and works in an area where new bicycle infrastructure is proposed. Except this bike lane had already been approved when, poof, it didn't happen. Good morning, Heidi. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. August 8th, you wrote an article titled, quote, "Still fuming about 35th Avenue Northeast, Seattle City Council considers new bike lane requirements." It was published in the Seattle Times, for which you are a staff reporter, and I found it intriguing. Give us a little backstory to this piece. What happened on 35th Avenue Northeast?
Sure. So this was a really controversial recent bike lane project that was proposed here in Seattle. So it was about a 2.3-mile section of road that the city's transportation department planned to repave and reconfigure. And as part of that, they were going to build protected bike lanes on that road. This was met with a lot of resistance from certain groups in the neighborhood. The opposition was, as it always is, kind of came from a few directions. You know, I think some people just weren't convinced that bike lanes were necessary in the area. Some people had concerns about removing parking to make room for the bike lanes. That's often a debate that happens among business owners. And some people said, you know, there's a neighborhood greenway about four blocks away, so one of these kind of slow streets that cyclists could use, and they don't actually need bike lanes on this road. So this opposition really heated up. At one point, the mayor had the two sides meet with a mediator because things had gotten so heated. And so it kind of became this litmus test for everyone. You know, was the mayor, you know, in some people's view, going to prioritize bike lanes at the expense of other modes? Or from the other side, you know, was she committed to safety in this area? Was she going to build bike lanes that would help keep cyclists safe? And so eventually the mayor and the Department of Transportation canceled this bike lane project. And they, in doing that, emphasized, you know, as I said, this alternative four blocks away, which cyclists say just isn't a good alternative. And so they canceled the bike lane project on 35th Avenue Northeast. They did the repaving. They still removed some of the parking. And now we're in a situation where people are using that street, and some people on bikes are, you know, sharing helmet cam videos, for example, and showing what they feel is a really dangerous street where cars are passing them at high speeds. And so the debate kind of reached a high point, and then the bike lanes were canceled. And now it's still simmering where people are saying, you still have a problem you didn't fix here. And that's what's led the city council to try to figure out, okay, how do we stop this kind of cancellation from happening again?
So I guess the question that comes up for me is, when, if you have a complete streets program, which Seattle, mm-hmm. I think, does, when they repave, and weren't there already bike lanes planned, and then now they decided to cancel them? So who has the right to do that if they were already approved?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's what, you know, some of the council members and the advocates for people who ride bikes are saying. You know, Seattle has, as I'm sure a lot of cities do, these long-term bike plans that go through a lot of community process. Everyone weighs in on what the best routes are, where we should prioritize connections, how we make biking safer in the city. And 35th was in those plans. It was a part of the, you know, it was in the bike plans. The bike lanes were in the repaving plans for the street. And that's part of what has left people feeling, the people who support the bike lanes feeling kind of bitter about this, you know, that they feel like they were promised something that was then canceled, and they don't feel like they have a good reason other than that some people in the neighborhood were angry. Of course, the city administration will say, you know, that that they make some safety claims that are debated about their design. They again claim that there's this alternative nearby. So, you know, it's still being debated, but you're right that people do feel like, who has the right to cancel this project?
So let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Heidi Groover. She's a staff reporter at the Seattle Times who specializes in transportation issues. And we are talking about the cancellation of a bike lane that was already put into the plans for this 35th Avenue Northeast. So even though there's a greenway four blocks away actually is a fairly big distance. If on 35th Avenue there are businesses and facilities that people want to get to by bike. So I don't know what the four blocks away is, but it could be a completely different neighborhood.
That's right. And it is, you know, in this case, it is roughly the same neighborhood as I understand it, but it isn't where all of the businesses are. It isn't where you probably are trying to get to. And, you know, we have a lot of hills in Seattle, so people often debate these types of alternatives. Are they really a good alternative? And, you know, I don't live in that neighborhood. I don't bike that area regularly. But what we're hearing from people who do use the area is that they don't feel like it's a good alternative.
So do you think that Seattle in general is committed to a Vision Zero plan? Do you, I assume you have one.
We do. The city has said that it's committed to Vision Zero. The mayor, the previous administration, and the new administration have, to varying degrees, said that they, you know, will continue to pursue the goal of Vision Zero. But a colleague of mine recently reported on some preliminary data from the city's transportation department, which, you know, we usually have to wait a long time, you know, almost to the next year to learn much information about all of the crashes that happened in the previous year. But she got some early data that shows that the number of people who've been seriously injured or killed in crashes in Seattle this year, in the first half of this year, it's the highest number of crashes in the first half of a year since 2010. So that really speaks to, you know, even as we commit to Vision Zero, the numbers are showing that that more people are being injured, more crashes are happening than were, you know, in 2010.
Yeah, that seems to be happening all across the country. That is not special to Seattle, unfortunately.
Right.
So I guess I'm wondering what's going to happen if it hasn't already. You said that they've already repaved 35th. They've taken some of the parking out. Is there a chance that this bike path will go back into effect, this bike lane?
I think it's unlikely. You know, a majority of the city council members have told me that they're concerned about the current design. You know, one called it a public health issue. You know, they've shared videos that they've received from people riding on that street and said this looks unsafe. But we're kind of dealing with a power sharing issue here between the city's Department of Transportation and the city council. And I think there's a hesitance to have too much micromanaging of where every bike lane goes. You know, the city council feels like this is the point of these bike plans that we have. And they just feel like, you know, something happened here and they seem a bit more focused on stopping it from happening again. That could change, you know, later this year, they'll go into their budget process. Perhaps they'll try to come up with a maneuver to force the bike lanes back on 35th. But what I see more likely is that they're just going to focus on putting as many guardrails in place to try to stop this from happening again. And so this recent story that we're talking about was about a piece of legislation that, you know, would say, okay, if there's a bike lane that's in the plan, and the Department of Transportation isn't going to build it, you need to at least spell out for us in writing why you didn't do it and what alternatives you considered and how you perceive a connected bike network happening without this project. So, you know, it's not the most hard-hitting thing I've ever seen, but it is some effort to try to make the department explain itself when this type of thing happens and surprises advocates in the community.
So I'm wondering how Seattle's commuting and cycling population is doing. Are more people cycling in Seattle? And are having those numbers grow if they are causing part of the issue? Or are drivers, like they are everywhere all over the country, just distracted, not seeing cyclists because they're not looking for them? The same things that are happening everywhere.
Well, I think both are involved. We have seen an increase in bike ridership in Seattle, according to the you know, bike counters that the administration has in a few places throughout the city. We do also have a growing population. We've seen a huge influx of people in recent years moving to Seattle, particularly for the tech jobs. So, you know, when we see numbers, even those Vision Zero numbers, everyone's aware that the entire population is going up, and so some of these numbers are going to go up. But congestion is getting pretty acute in our downtown, and people are hungry for alternatives to driving. And the city officials have just flat out said, we don't want you driving downtown in a single occupancy vehicle, so we want you to take alternatives. And that includes biking, and includes transit, of course, too. So I do think it's becoming an issue that at least you know, there's more public pressure to do things to make cycling safer. But we certainly are not, we're not different from other cities in the types of opposition that you see to these projects, questions about the cost as it relates to how many people are actually going to use it. All of those public debates that happen all over the country are still happening here too. It's by no means a utopia.
Well, I don't want to sound like I'm happy to hear this. I'm not happy to hear it, of course, but it does illustrate that it's not just an East Coast problem or a Washington, D.C. problem, that it is a nationwide problem. And I think that our speaking about it, our reporting on it, makes it more real. Thank you so much for doing this reporting. I found it very interesting. I thought the article was, obviously, it grabbed my attention. For those who are interested, you can find the article in the Seattle Times. It's titled, Still Fuming About 35th Avenue Northeast, Seattle City Council Considers New Bike Lane Requirements. It was posted by Heidi Groover. She is a Seattle Times staff reporter who reports on transportation. Thanks for talking with me. I hope you have a wonderful day, and we'll keep watching your articles. It was really good. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
All right. You have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks, Diane.
Okay, bye. Heidi Groover joined me from the offices of the Seattle Times, where she reports on transportation issues. If you'd like to read her article in full, you can log on to www.seattletimes.com/Seattle News Transportation. Let's take a break, and when we return, I have a couple of short news items, and then we'll speak with Michael Coville Anderson. It's a lively conversation. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Exciting women's pro racing is going on right now in the U.S. at the Colorado Classic, the elite pro women's stage race. First stage was won by Chloe Dygart in a huge way. She rode away with four jerseys, including the general classification, sprint leader, best young rider, and queen of the mountain. I believe we have the makings of quite a champion here. The most badass jersey went to Emily Newsom, and the most inspirational jersey went to Lindsay Goldman. How cool is it that there's so many field options for recognition? Meanwhile, if you're interested in watching the race as it winds down this weekend, you can stream it live, watch recaps, or read all about it at coloradoclassic.com. And just so you don't have a moment to rest, the Vuelta jumped off today, August 24th, with the team time trial in Alicante, Spain, and will conclude in Madrid on September 15th. One of the best sites I saw for daily updates with lots of graphs and links is cycling.co.uk. And last but not least, I'd like to mention a ride that's coming up in Ohio. The Cincinnati Cycling Club is putting on their Great Pumpkin Roll Ride on September 28th. Benefiting the Hamilton County Special Olympics, the first group leaves the start at 8:30 a.m. from 9660 Dry Fork Road in Harrison, Ohio. Terrain is rolling. Well, I know it's hilly down there, so their rolling might be my undoing. But there are routes of 24, 40, 50, and 65 miles, as well as a new 8-mile family ride that will start at 10 a.m. One of the things that really brought this ride to my attention, their graphics. They're remarkably beautiful. If you're interested, you can find out all about the Great Pumpkin Roll Ride at greatpumpkinrollride.com. That's the news for this week. We're going to take another real short break, and when we come back, we'll speak with Michael Coville Anderson. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Diane Jenks. Michael Colville Anderson is a force to be reckoned with, and his exceptionally unique perspective on urban planning comes from his practical way of living in his home country of Denmark. I think you'll enjoy this conversation. Hello, Michael Colville Anderson. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today. I'm really pleased to be able to chat with you.
Thanks very much.
Well, I've been watching some of your videos and reading some of the things you have to say, and you certainly make a lot of sense to me, and you will make a lot of sense to my listeners, since many of us are both bicycle advocates and cyclists. Can you begin?
I'm neither.
What do you mean?
I'm neither.
Well, all right. Well, go ahead. Forget that. What do you, they'll explain that. What are you?
No, I don't know. I don't advocate sort of, you know, like activists or advocates do. I talk about what I think should be done in regarding urban design and urban planning. And I'm always the first person to say that I'm not a cyclist. I don't, you know, I'm just, a guy who rides a bike in a city. I can't fix a bike. I'm not a bike geek. 1950 Swedish vintage bike found in a summer house is, you know, the best bike for me, you know. So like in that sense, I'm not like a cyclist with the air quotes. I'm just a man who believes in the bicycle as transport in our cities.
Yes, you do. Tell us a little about your background, where you grew up and how you became so interested in this topic, simplifying urban planning, how cycling fits into that philosophy.
Yeah, we're Danish, but I grew up in Canada, in Calgary, and, should I wait for the beeps there? I'm in a car parking lot, ironically.
Of course.
In Hamilton, Ontario. Yeah. So I grew up in Calgary, son of Danish immigrants. And I was a film director and a photographer for many years. And then I sort of randomly came at this. It's probably the story I've told the most, really, how I just took one photo one day in 2006. And people reacted to that on Flickr. And, it's just a regular Copenhagener on a bike. And people were saying, dude, how does she ride a bike in a skirt, you know, and in those boots? Like, it was a weird thing. And I'm going, I don't know what you're talking about, because that's normal for us, right?
Right.
In Copenhagen. So, and that just exploded in my face. And that became cycle chic, you know, back in 2006 and 7. And then that led me to sort of explore, as also a journalist, why are people reacting to this, something that is completely normal for us in Copenhagen? And then I started the Copenhagenize as a blog. And then that led to urban planning. I just did a lot of thinking about it. And apparently the stuff that came out of my brain and my mouth was interesting to people, because we have lived for decades with this car-centric urban planning and urban design, and we haven't really put much thought into it. So all of a sudden somebody's saying something different and coming at it from a very proudly non-academic point of view. You know, I'm not burdened by academia, having learned all the university things you learn about urban planning and stuff. It just sort of came out of fresh, I guess, and that might have been interesting to some people. So I just sort of kept going with that. And, you know, now I've worked in over 100 cities around the world as an urban designer, mostly with bicycle infrastructure, but also moving into sort of general urbanism now and tactical urbanisms and things. That's what I'm doing now.
You know, I think many of us who ride bicycles, we won't say we're cyclists, are finding it so depressing and confounding here in the U.S. that we're just terrified, or I'm terrified, to be on the streets. Drivers don't see us. Drivers don't care about us. Drivers think we're a nuisance. They say we don't pay our taxes, which, of course, is just BS. I mean, we all pay taxes. So, I mean, they make up all this stuff, and they're so intolerant of cyclists. How do you change that attitude?
I mean, motorists are, douchebags everywhere in the world, right? It's I work a lot with transport psychology, so it's, in a way, it's not their fault, but I mean, they have been led to believe that you have to sit inside this, this box and drive around and invest a lot of money in it. And they feel ownership over the roads. But this is also because of, more in America, but also it's quite universal. The urban design of our cities, the urban planning, car centric, the width of the car lanes, 70, 80 years in the U.S. of a really dominant philosophy. And in practice also, of that cars are the primary transport form. And now in the past 10, 12 years, I mean, we're starting to realize, wait, that might have been a brain fart. We might have screwed things up there. And it's an interesting age. I call it the age of urbanism. We're thinking differently about our cities now. More than we have in the past 100 years, really all over the world. But that all dominating philosophy that cars are the primary transport form in cities has created the culture, the mentality that motorists suffer from, that, you know, they are, you know, the top of the food chain. The only thing we can do is infrastructure. There's no chicken and egg. There's only infrastructure. You can't have high cycling levels without any protected bike lanes anywhere in the world. Nobody's ever done it. So we know from 100 years of experience in Copenhagen, it was 1915 when we first put in a protected bike lane, and that design's pretty much nailed now. So we know that, you know, if you you create a network of protected bike lanes, you I don't like to say take away space from the cars. I guess for your listeners, that'd probably be the best thing to say. But I mean, I like to say reallocate the urban space, redemocratize it so that it's not just a transport dictatorship. It's actually a transport democracy where we can take the bus, tram, streetcar, or a bike, you know, and or also pedestrian friendly facilities. So, I mean, this is really 100 years of urban brain fart that we are starting to reverse. But man, it's slow in the United States compared to what's happening around the rest of the world, because it's even more dominant for you guys.
Right, it is. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Michael Coville Anderson. You live in Copenhagen, right?
Yeah, I'm from Copenhagen. Yeah.
Okay. But he's in Canada right now working on a television series, which we'll talk about in a little bit. I watched one of your videos. Actually, it was a TEDx talk, I think. And you talk about something called desire lines.
Yeah.
Explain that. I think that's really cool. I thought it was very cool, and it made perfect sense to me.
I mean, first of all, it is a phrase that somebody, and nobody really knows who named it that.
Claim
which
it.
Which is, I find interesting, but yeah, right. Whoever did it is probably dead, so I could totally nail the copyright.
There you
but
go.
No, it's really how, you know, every city was formed. You know, the old winding streets of European cities, they were desire lines. Some shepherd was schlepping through there with his sheep, and you know, a pathway was formed, and later settlement came, more people moved in, cities were formed based on, you know, the optimal A to B across whatever landscape they were in. So, I mean, in Dutch, down in the Netherlands, they call them elephant paths instead of desire lines, which is really, you know, the elephants have their pathways and their network through the deserts and the jungles. So it's urban democracy. You know, it is democracy in motion. You especially, you know, in North American cities, you know, you have like a park on a corner, and you can see the grass is trodden, you know, cutting off the corner, because that's the people who use it. That's their desire line. It makes more sense to them to just cut across a corner. We see a sort of a growing movement with desire lines, but it's sort of been in place in landscape architecture for a long time. You know, you make a park and you put in some pathways, and then you go back after a year in some planning cultures, and they say, oh man, look at the grass. That's where the people want to go. Oh, we forgot there's like a bus stop over there. Oh, of course. And then, you know, you relay new pathways based on the desire lines of the citizens. So, I mean, I took that concept and adopted it to bicycle urbanism. You know, how are people using an intersection in Copenhagen, in Paris, Barcelona, Montreal? I've stared literally at like 106,000 cyclists in five or six cities, trying to study their desire lines through these inherently car-centric intersections, and trying to figure out ways of designing them better and, you know, make them safer for cyclists and pedestrians, just trying to think out of the box a bit. But really it is our cities, you know, they are just nothing but desire lines. And I'm standing here in Hamilton, Ontario, which is like a traditional grid system, in a car parking lot, as I said, but you know, it's the built form here makes it hard maybe to establish desire lines, but I mean, you do see them everywhere. Once you see them, you'll never unsee them through a park or, you know, through any urban landscape. So it's really a way, I think, of highlighting how the citizens of our cities, they know better how to use the urban landscape than the planners and the engineers sitting in an office many kilometers away, right? So looking at how the people use it, that's how they should tell us through their desire lines, through their urban desires, where they want to go, how they want to get there, and we should adopt our planning based on these desire lines is my philosophy.
So this is reversed from what is happening now. So urban planners say, and perfect example here where we live is the worst parking lot in the world at a Whole Foods market. It's just insane the way they set it up. And I'm thinking, yep. Who thought this up? And if you watch the way the traffic actually works, the way the people come into the store, go out of the store, want to cross over, you'd say, this is ridiculous. So what you're saying is watch what's going on first and plan around that, as opposed to plan something and hope people fall into that pattern because you said so.
Yeah, I mean, and there's an incredible amount of arrogance over the past many decades from planners and particularly engineers, who in the North American context really dominate the conversation. You know, it's totally arrogant to assume that we will build this and they will just, you know, dutifully do exactly what we want them to do. If you look, as I often do, at the 7,000 years of cities, you know, ever since we started moving together in cities, I mean, most cities were formed based on the desires of the people using it on a daily basis and not in a distant office looking down at maps or computer models, which is the dominant sort of modus operandi, you know, in many parts of the world still. So yeah, it's the people who live in this neighborhood that I'm standing in. They know how they want to use it. You know, they may, you know, they want to cut across the parking lot instead of following, you know, slavishly the sidewalks in a grid system. They know the fastest way from A to B, because they use it every day. So we have to start looking at that, which we are doing. I mean, it really is something that is still budding, but it is a philosophy that a lot of cities are looking at. City of Copenhagen is good at it for bikes. They see that, oh, they're all taking a shortcut across the damn sidewalk. That's illegal. Instead of putting up fences to block that behavior, the city of Copenhagen will actually implement bicycle infrastructure based on the desire lines of the city's many cyclists. So it's a thing, it's growing, and it should become more of a thing because we are urban citizens and we live in democracies, and you know, we should be able to vote with our feet on our A to B journeys throughout the city.
Yeah, nice. Vote with our feet. I like that. You use a phrase called the arrogance of space. Wonderful phrase. Explain what that means.
Thanks. Similar vein, you know, this, when you look at sort of the traffic engineering standards that were formed in the States, really, you guys started the car thing earlier than us. We really in Europe and the rest of the world, started it after the Second World War in the 1950s, but we sort of copy pasted everything that the Americans had been doing for so long. And really, you know, the way that we've been forming our cities, grid system and blocks like that, in North America here, it's kind of like playing with Duplo, right? Where we need to play with Lego. I'm using a Danish reference here. like Lego has a lot more opportunity for design, where Duplo is just these big clunky blocks that, like, you know, 1 or 2 year olds use. And that's really how it feels sometimes being in a North American city. But also with that sort of block planning culture that had evolved, we also were left with a lot of space. And just this whole mentality back in the 40s and the 50s, like, you know, let's do everything to expedite cars, journeys everywhere. So you see, like in North America, man, you got car lanes that are wider than some European countries, you know. It's, you know, in Europe, we've narrowed them down because a narrow car lane is actually safer. You have to concentrate when you're driving, which is a good thing that motorists concentrate more, right?
Right. So
there's just a lot of leftover, like, space that is absolutely arrogantly, you know, expropriated from the rest of us and given over to cars, be it a parking lot, be it the width of a car lane, corners where the curb is like a curve so that, ooh, cars don't have to slow down so much. They can just sort of roll around the corner instead of having to do a sharp 90-degree turn. We see actually a change now in many cities in Europe where they're actually, you know, making the corners back into the 90-degree curbs instead of this rolling curve around the corner for cars. So it really, the space in our cities that has been allocated to the automobile, streets and parking and everything, it's arrogant, and it doesn't represent every citizen in the city. You know, in your American context, you have a lot of kids and you have a lot of elderly who can't drive. They have no other option in order, you know, to get around if they can't use a car. So the built environment is only designed or engineered for cars. So we got to start, you know, chipping away at that urban space and, again, reallocating it for general use and not just, you know, getting motorized vehicles from their A to their B to their C. We have to think about the big picture now.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Michael Colville Anderson. He is an urban planner, but not in the usual sense. Fortunately, thank goodness. So you actually have some wonderful books. You have some wonderful TED Talks. You have some you're prolific. You clearly live and breathe this stuff. Take a step back for a second. And if you look at the big picture in a place that you go where somebody says, come on in, Michael, we want you to help us make changes. What are some of the things that you can tell a community that is so gridlocked right now? how would you even start making some changes?
It really is, I've learned, you know, in working with, you know, over 100 cities around the world, it's different from place to place. You can go into a European city and there are some people cycling and like regular people on bikes, you know, just in their regular clothes. And they kind of get it because they have it a little bit there. So they're sort of maybe at a different point of departure than, you know, an American city where there's just a handful of hardcore cyclists, you know, cycling despite it all. And then what kind of engineering culture we're dealing with as well, you know, it's very different. But I mean, like in my book, Copenhagenized, the, I can't even remember the name of the book.
Oh, let me help you. The Definitive Guide to Global Bicycle Urbanization.
Yeah, there you go. It was a year ago I published that. God, I can't even remember. In my book, Copenhagenized, the Definitive Guide to Global Bicycle Urbanism, I have a whole chapter to myth busting because, man, if I had a dollar for every time I've had to bust a myth about urban cycling, you know, I'd be Skyping you from my island in the Bahamas right now, you know, but I'm not. I'm in Hamilton, Ontario, but the Bahamas of North America. No, but it's really bizarre how you have to explain stuff to otherwise intelligent people. There are so many misconceptions about cycling. Regular citizens just see the spandex crew and they think those people are not us and they're a different subculture of Homo sapiens or, you know, a subspecies or whatever. But really, you know, when you start to understand urban cycling for the 99%, which is like me, you know, just the regular people on bikes, I mean, you know, you look at it differently. But just, you know, oh, you put in a bike lane and our shops are going to die on this street. You know, there's no evidence anywhere in the world from the past 40 years that if you do bicycle infrastructure well, that shops will suffer. On the contrary, they'll increase their profits by between 30% and 50%. You know, all the studies for years have shown that. And, you know, oh, yeah, damn, the cyclist should pay, you know, tax, you know, or a road tax, but motorists don't pay road tax either. You know what I mean? It's, you know, most places it's your real estate taxes that go to the hard infrastructure of the streets. But, you know, if we start taxing cyclists and we have to start taxing pedestrians, you know, every time you buy a pair of shoes, you got to tax that because those damn pedestrians are using the sidewalks, you know, and wearing them down. There's just not a lot of logic and there's just a lot of misconception. And really the job is to repeat myself ad nauseum all over the world. And hopefully, you know, that becomes the truth and not the, you know, the misconceptions everywhere. So it depends where I am and who I'm talking to, but it really is the baseline. I'm going to start by busting some myths. And then if they're receptive to it, then we can get to work and start talking about how, you know, to change the urban landscape and make it better for cycling. And if you do that, you just make a better city. You know, like it's not just bikes. It's the bicycle is the most important tool in our urban toolbox from, in, you know, making cities better for forcing the urban change that we so desperately need, you know? So it's not a bike. I'm not the bike guy. You know, I'm just saying bikes are the tool, man. This is the gateway, you know, to improving urban life.
So you just brought something up for me that maybe you can illustrate this with. If you, and people from all over the world listen to this podcast, so it's not like we are just focused here in the United States, although mostly, but if you could take one of these cities that you've gone to and they've asked you to make some changes, illustrate one city that maybe you came in and it was like this and now it's like that.
Yeah, if we can talk in a year or so, I hopefully will be able to talk about Detroit because I designed the bike with the team I was working with, the infrastructure, the bicycle infrastructure, the bicycle strategy for the city of Detroit. And they came to us saying, we are not the motor city anymore. We want to be the mobility city. So they had an incredibly visionary approach to it. And the head of their planning department, Maurice Cox, this guy gets it, you know. So we came in there going, what? Really? Detroit? You guys are talking the top. Wow, this is amazing. And then, you know, we made the huge document for them and let's hope that they start to build it. But really the best project I've ever had anywhere is a small city in Tatarstan, which is a republic in Russia. So nobody was calling from Russia ever, you know, about bikes in city. You know, every city in the world was bicycle friendly for decades. You know, like 100 years ago, there was 20% of the population of Los Angeles was on bikes, you know, but then we all forgot it after we focused on the car in the 40s and 50s, right? And on to today. But this city, we got this email saying, hey, we want to become the most bicycle friendly city in Russia. And I'm like, we literally laughed in the office, you know, I'm like, yeah, right. Seriously, come on. You know, the exchange rate's incredibly bad for them, you know, so it'll be really expensive and everything. But no, they insisted and we went there and there's 160,000 people. It's like an oil town. For the Canadians, it's really the Fort McMurray of Russia. The oil comes out of the ground there. So it's like the whole storytelling is just bizarre. So it makes it even better. But then the mayor there, this 35-year-old man, much loved in the city, very popular. He said, no, I get this urbanism thing. You know, and I'm going, really? Wow. In the middle of Russia. And you get it. He's going, I get it totally. I did this huge park and everybody said, don't do a park. We have shopping malls. And he built a park and now everybody goes to the park, you know? He said, but now the bikes. So we did that and we just told him exactly what to do. And he told his engineers just to shut up and listen to us. Best client ever. When people just do what you say. I'll never have a job like that again. But, you know, and then, the goal for them was, you know, there was nobody riding bikes when we got there. A couple of kids we saw in a housing estate. And the goal is 10% on bikes by, after 5 years, and it's 4 years in and they're at 8%, and they're gonna totally hit the 10%. They just built an entire bicycle infrastructure network in like really hardwired protected bike lanes based on the Copenhagen standard from 1915 across the city. And really the best bicycle infrastructure on the planet today is in that town, you know, like quality wise and width wise and everything, even better than Copenhagen in the big picture. So that's really the best project. But that city, if they can do it in the middle of that country and that, you know, it's like we can see that there's a momentum now. And, you know, any city that's not doing stuff like this, it's getting to be really a bit awkward, you know, because it is really a global boom and the boom is not, you know, diminishing in any way. City after city, some are slow, some are quick, but man, it's happening. So that's, for me, that's just a great project to work on, but also a great symbol that weird places are doing this now. You know, Detroit, sorry, I don't mean Detroit's a weird place, but based on their, you know, their recent history, you kind of go, wow, we didn't expect them to call, you know?
Right.
So that's what we see in the world, you know, unusual places. And really the glue with all of these places is, the right politicians or the right, you know, head of transport. They get it. They went on a study trip to Copenhagen or, you know, they really put their mind to this and they said, I get this now. Now let's go. And they can do it fast. You know, no more baby steps. It's getting a bit old school to do baby steps. One bike lane on one street. Let's study it for 2 years, see how that works. Completely useless. You need a network. The network has to fall from the sky and you're on your way.
Oh, I like that. Just like, you know, put it over the city and let it fall into place. I like that a lot. That's very cool. Very cool. So tell us, you're in Canada to do a television show. Tell me about your television series.
Yeah, well, a few years ago, I sort of got the idea for The Life-Sized City, as the show is called. And I had a friend who was a producer in Montreal. So we started working on this, developing it. And now we're shooting season three. It's really, we always do a little bit of a bike segment if we can, but it's really urbanism. It's all about this age of urbanism, how people are taking matters into their own hands, how citizens are waking up after, you know, being in hibernation for 70 years and realizing that they can actually, with their own hands, transform their street or their neighborhood or, you know, in the bigger picture, their city. Talking to architects and planners, some politicians, but a lot of citizen groups who are just saying, enough is enough, let's go, let's do stuff. And it's always global, man. It's not like there's never been sort of one starting pistol anywhere in the world, like there was with the bike boom in a way in 2006 or seven. You know, it's sort of like it's just sort of this collective consciousness all over the world. We're tired of waiting. We're tired of car-centric planning. Let's start taking back our streets. So that's what I curate, you know, for, I'm the host of it and I curate it for, you know, for the viewers. So, inspiring them, you know, one idea in Buenos Aires that could totally inspire some people sitting in Des Moines, Iowa and say, wow, let's do that. That would fit perfectly in that park we have down the road. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like the internet does, you know, sort of gives us ideas around the world, but it's all packaged into one little, you know, it's the world's first documentary series about urbanism. So it's really sort of focused on that. So yeah, I'm here in Hamilton. We're going to do, an episode. We mostly do large cities, Paris, Tokyo, Buenos Aires, Copenhagen, but we're going to do a little mid-sized episode here. Hamilton's really like the Pittsburgh of Canada, the steel town that's been struggling. So it kind of mirrors what happened in Pittsburgh. But yeah, it's really exciting. This is where I'm going now, is more and more of this work with urbanism, tactical urbanism, and continuing to shoot this series.
Well, you have so much going on. Anybody who is interested, and I can't imagine almost anybody who listens to the show who won't be interested. You have books and you have TV and media and you have TED Talks, more than one, more than two. And you have a book that we really can't say the whole title on the air. We can say it, but then we'll have to bleep it.
Americans, man.
Yeah, you guys, we have, but remember, we're Americans that have the FCC. So we can say it on the podcast, but we cannot say it on the broadcast. So there's this little magic button on my editing software where I can just go bleep, but it's called A Short Introduction to Bicycle Urbanism for people who don't give a
fuck.
There. And that's fine with me. It's not like I've never heard the word or used the word myself. So it is available as a paperback or a PDF. Tell us what that is. It's really cute. What's it about? It's very simple. It's for people who don't read a lot, too. It's not a lot of words.
Well, last year I summarized in one heavy tome, you know, everything I've been working with for the past 12 years. You know, Copenhagen Eyes, the definitive guide to global bicycle urbanism. Everything hopefully is in the book, you know, a design, you know, marketing. How do we talk about this? Absolutely every aspect of it. Myth busting, you name it. And then that's great. And that's, you know, doing well. It's a Island Press, an American publisher that they published it. And then I was going to write an article just, you know, a few months ago, just like, how do I talk to the people, the skeptics, you know, the NIMBYs? How do you actually talk to them about this? And then I thought, oh, wait, I'm just going to just self-publish this, man. It's the internet. So like 2 days, I just hammered out this this book, and it's sort of more fun and irreverent than my other book, which is sort of more, you know, professional, still has my voice in it. But I mean, this book is just like, you know, I think the introduction says, you know, I don't want to write this book, but I have to because people like you exist, you know, meaning the skeptic who's reading. Right. So this, you know, so it's really funny. Like, you know, we can read it and get a laugh and hopefully use some of the data and the stats that I do present in the book, short and sweet. But then it's kind of fun after we read it, we can just sort of slip it onto the desk of that one colleague who keeps, you know, talking bad about bikes, or that one family member who always goes blah, blah, blah about bikes, you know. So it's just kind of, it's a multi-use book. You can read it, have a laugh, and then hand it off to the person who will hate it the most. You have to give it to the person who will hate it the most. That's kind of, you know, it's sort of a contract we sign when you buy it, but I mean, I really want you to do that. And it's also available in 6 languages, and I got 4 more languages coming. My whole network just went, oh my God, I want to translate that into Turkish, into Italian, into French. So it's all out on blurb.com, where you can buy it on demand as a PDF or as a print version.
It's awesome. A Short Introduction to Bicycle Urbanism for people who don't give a, okay.
Fuck.
Yeah. I love it. Well, this has just been such a good conversation. I would love at some point for you to come to Northeast Ohio, but Detroit wasn't so far away. So we are not, we're only 3 hours from Detroit. We're in Cleveland.
Yeah. I read on my radar, Cleveland and Cincinnati. There's some good small scale urbanism going on in these cities. I need larger scale, but I've registered them on the radar of good things.
Michael, tell us about the television series. Can we see it here in the States?
Hopefully soon, because it's sold to, I think, 13, 14 countries now. And we are on the cusp of selling it to an American broadcaster. So I'm looking forward to be able to say when and where and who that's going to be, you know, within the next couple of months. But there's a YouTube channel. If you look for The Life-Size City, we got like, I don't know, like 60 different clips from all the different episodes around the world. So you get a little taste of what it is. And, you know, so it's coming to the States shortly. You can see it in Canada, in Belgium, Denmark, Poland, a whole bunch of countries, right? But we're looking forward to bringing it to the American audience.
So what we'll do is we'll post the YouTube link so people can see it on the Facebook page and on Twitter. And then we'll look for it. Maybe Julie, your assistant, can let me know when that's available and we'll push it out there. How would that be?
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward. I mean, it's a big market and, you know, like I'm a huge network in North in the States. So, yeah, we're just kind of aching for this to come out in the States. Right.
Right.
We'll let you know. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, Michael, thank you so much for talking with me. I want to let people know how to find out all of your stuff. Michael Coville Anderson. It is Coville-Anderson with an E, not an O, .com.
Dang.
Oh, you're That's welcome. Right. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoy your stay in Hamilton, and maybe we should talk again sometime.
Absolutely. It'd be a pleasure. Thanks very much.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Michael Colville Anderson joined me from a parking lot in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Good thing the weather was cooperative. Meanwhile, if you are interested in his work, if you want to hear any of his TED Talks or watch any of his videos, you can log on to colville-anderson.com. And Anderson is spelled A-N-D-E-R-S-E-N. So my thanks to Michael, as well as to Jessica Cicchino from IIHS and Heidi Groover from the Seattle Times. Next week, which is already Labor Day weekend, we have a conversation with the two-time Guinness World Record holder, and we'll be talking about getting back on the bike after a crash. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please leave a review on your favorite podcast app, and don't hesitate to get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter, or on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening. Ride safely, and we'll see you next week.